Trib Live Radio presents The Josh Taylor Show, Wednesdays 2 p.m. to 3 p.m.
I just asked him to buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks.
I don't care if he ever gets back.
The young voice of Pittsburgh sports, Trib Total Media. See what's next.
You can do it all night long!
Now, JT on TLR.
You know, I've noticed something, and this is based off of the fact that there are a lot of good things going on right now. There's a lot of positive things. There's a lot of good reasons to be happy. It's a really, really nice day. Hardly any clouds out. Sky's bright, sun's out. Fairly warm day for November in Pittsburgh. Why? I don't know. The fickle Pittsburgh weather at its finest, but on the plus side of the ledger, no less. But I've noticed that, and this is a weird Larry David type observation that I've made of myself. I've noticed that there are times when I'm generally trying to be positive, and people kind of jump on you for being positive. For instance, you look like, oh man, it's a nice day. It's a great day to be alive. Oh, shut up. You suck. People go crazy. You try to be just the slightest bit positive, and the most miserable people in the world just look at you like you're insane. Then, there's days when maybe you're not feeling as positive. You're kind of just, I'm here, kind of doing my thing. And then someone randomly walks up to you and goes, why don't you just smile? And you're just like, what the hell? They do their best John L. Smith impersonation. Smile! And like they're looking at you sideways. It's weird. I notice that because there's days when I'm both people. There's days when I'm the positive person. Everybody's like, why are you so happy? And then there's days I'm like, and everybody's like, why aren't you smiling? I really can't win either way. It's kind of like the story of my life. Anyway, I'm way off topic and we haven't even started the show yet. Bottom line is it's a nice day outside and it's actually a pretty cool day in autumn. So if you're not doing anything today, go outside. Hopefully you're listening to this show or to this podcast while you're doing that. But it's a beautiful Wednesday afternoon here in Pittsburgh, and you are listening to the Josh Taylor Show on Trib Live Radio. There are some things we want to get into. I got a lot to get into today, so hopefully we get to do it because there's so much stuff I want to talk about. And we got some really good football talk coming up in about 20 minutes. Alex Kozora, SteelersDepot.com will join us. Got a couple questions for him. We'll talk about Le'Veon Bell's injury. We will talk some film study. This is something new that we're going to do throughout the football season. Alex and I have talked about this before the season started, and it's kind of a new thing we're going to do. We're going to talk some film study, and specifically, we're talking special teams. Most people would think special teams talk is boring. This one's interesting because it carries a certain narrative attached to it that Steeler fans have gotten used to, like, latching onto, which is really a bad habit. I don't know if you guys remember my rant. I think it was back in August about lazy sports fans. Well, one thing football fans that I've noticed is that they tend to latch on to the same narratives even long after that narrative doesn't fit anymore. And this is one of those, I like to call them lazy sports myths. I'm going to bust a myth this afternoon with Alex Kozora. At least I think it's a myth that should be busted. But we'll talk about that. And we'll talk about some other stuff too. This week's That's What's Up. We're going to leave it for the third segment of the show because we've been doing That's What's Up now for about 4 weeks. We will get into that later on in the show. It's a really, really great story that's happening here locally in Pittsburgh. And I think it's something that a lot of people could probably stand to hear. I think it'll make their day a little bit brighter. And it's a really great story of when life is bigger than the game. And I think it's an awesome thing to discuss. So we'll talk about That's What's Up later on in the show. But before we get to all that, we now know about the initial college football playoff rankings. They were released last night. Much to the chagrin of probably all but four fan bases in America, and even some of them, even some of those four fan bases are still upset because of the rankings. There are some fans of teams whose team is ranked in the top four and they still don't like the rankings. It's pretty ridiculous. But we're going to give what I like to call and I'm going to do a lot of this throughout the season. Probably not every week on this show, but we're going to do it quite a bit. Pretty much when the spirit moves me, because I think it's worth acknowledging, and I unabashedly consider myself someone who talks about college football probably more than the average person in this town, and that's fine. I can live with that. I'll wear it. But we're going to do a state of the college football playoff address, and today will be my first one. And everybody who listens to this podcast and listens to this show knows that I like to quote Jay-Z at the end of my show. Well, for my first state of the college football playoff address, I'm gonna quote Jay-Z at the beginning of my show. And I'm going to use it for my first state of the college football playoff address. And here's the quote. The quote that I'm going to use as the theme of my first college football playoff address. Stick to the script. This is why you should not get out of sorts about the first college football playoff rankings. Because right now, with Jeff Long and the college football playoff committee, what they're doing is they're sticking to the script. And the script usually has the same characteristics. One of those things, as far as sticking to the script, you always know that there's going to be one team that's red hot that's out in front. Now, let's, for everybody questioning, let's run down the top four. Clemson in at number one, LSU number two, Ohio State number three, Alabama number four. Now let's get into why we think the college football playoff committee, or at least I do, why I think they're sticking to the script. Usually those early rankings, whether they be preseason AP, coaches, poll, even college football playoff rankings, even though the early ones have only been issued twice, it's only the second season to do it. But they already have their script in mind, and it does not surprise me at all. Now remember, one of the main things that Jeff Long talked about when this committee was first formed and they talked about their criteria for putting this playoff together was that they were going to put a high, very, very high emphasis on conference champions. Baylor and TCU fans, if you haven't figured it out yet, that's why your team didn't get in. Because your team's conference doesn't know how to pick a champion. Hopefully by now they figured it out. But this is where the script comes in. And this top four ranking for early in the season, this is what we have so far. This is what I've noticed. There's always one team that's kind of the hot favorite. That's kind of the hot pick. That kind of stands out amongst the rest. And this year, that team is Clemson. Clemson's the number one pick overall in the first ranking, I believe, because Clemson's that hot team that's out there, that's getting a lot of attention, winning some good games, but maybe not everybody knows. So they're getting more attention now by being that number one pick in the playoff rankings. Now, bear in mind, remember something. The team that was number one in the first rankings last year did not win the national championship. So, let's remember all that. Now, when you look at Clemson's schedule, it's not overly impressive, but part of it's not their fault. They play in the ACC. They're in the division that may not necessarily flatter them so much, but their non-conference schedule was Wofford, Appalachian State, and Notre Dame. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because when you're talking about Notre Dame, that opens up a whole other can of worms, because Notre Dame is a team that's still a player in this whole scenario. And I know a lot of people, the first thing they're going to think is, oh, why does Notre Dame have to be in it? Well, if they're talking about conference championships, why is Notre Dame involved? Notre Dame has to be involved because they're Notre Dame. It's another element to the script. Notre Dame will always be involved in the beginning as long as Notre Dame is still Notre Dame. And that's probably a really weird way to phrase it, and it probably confuses some people. So let me explain. As long as Notre Dame has some merit behind their schedule and their resume and what they've done so far, which they do. Notre Dame's got a pretty strong case. They're 7-1. The one team they've lost to is a team that's number one in Clemson. And where's Notre Dame? Number five. right there on the outside, looking in. Which, believe it or not, is part of the script. Remember what I told you. Hot team, Notre Dame being Notre Dame. Those are two things that are involved in the script. Another thing involved in the script. A lot of people get this miscast. They look at it the wrong way. They think it's an SEC bias. The problem with that is the SEC bias kind of left the room towards the end of the BCS. And it really isn't the fact that the SEC being dominant above everybody else. It's not about the 14 teams in the conference. No. It's about half of the conference. It's not about the SEC. It's about the SEC West. Part of the script is the committee hedges their bets on the SEC West champion. Why? Because the SEC West champion will more than likely win the SEC championship game. Therefore, the SEC West champion has the best opportunity, or at least the best chances, if they're sticking to the script, of finding a spot in the college football playoff. How do we know that? Look at Alabama last year. So when people look at the initial ranking, go, LSU's number two and Alabama's number four. What is going on? Stick to the script. One of these two teams will not be here in less than a week. Remember, LSU and Alabama have to face each other. That will sort itself out in about, 3 days? It's going to be fine. Don't freak out over this. It's not worth overanalyzing, because remember what we said last year when there was all the talk about all these ranked teams, because Ole Miss was in it, and Mississippi State was number one, and Alabama was up there, and there was still Auburn in the picture. It eventually shook itself out. What did those four teams, Alabama, Auburn, LSU, and Mississippi State, what did they all have in common? Say it with me. They're all in the SEC West. And eventually, they all had to play each other. I remember talking about the same topic a year ago. How they were all going to cancel itself out, and the team left standing would be the one that wins the SEC West, likely win the SEC championship game, and probably end up in the playoff. And that's exactly what happened, because Alabama survived. That's part of the script. Now, I say all that with one caveat. There is one team that could actually mess that up for the first time in a long time. And that team, believe it or not, that team is Florida. Who imagined me saying that a year ago? That's kind of strange, isn't it? Will Muschamp out, Jim McElwain in. Florida, back in the discussion. Guess who was ranked number 10 in the original college football playoff ranking? Florida Gators. They could be the team that messes it all up. Because let's say, for the sake of argument, Florida wins out, gets to the SEC championship game after winning the SEC East Division, and beats the SEC West champion, whether it be LSU, who they lost to earlier this season, by the way, or Alabama. Then by association, Florida will win the SEC and probably find their way into the college football playoff. And here's two reasons why. Actually, there's three why that's plausible. One, LSU beat Florida earlier this season. So Florida beats LSU while they're ranked in the top four after they beat them once already. Or I should say, if Florida beats LSU while LSU is in the top four, with LSU having beaten Florida earlier this season, that should be a feather in Florida's cap, shouldn't it? In the converse, let's say they beat Alabama, not LSU. Let's say Alabama beats LSU this weekend. Florida gets to the SEC championship game and beats Alabama, assuming Alabama's in the top four. Shouldn't that be a feather in Florida's cap? Absolutely. But then some of you out there, some of you SEC haters will go, well, Florida has one loss, but they won the SEC championship game. Why should they be in the playoff? Because the exact same thing happened with Ohio State last year. That's why. Remember when Ohio State went crazy? After losing to Virginia Tech at home, a team which, by the way, lost to Pitt last year. Ohio State lost to a team at home that lost to Pitt, yet won their conference championship game and ended up in the college football playoff. I know, it was much to the chagrin of Baylor and TCU fans. Please refer to my previous statement about the Big 12 screwing yourself up. I'm not going to keep having this argument. Just go back to me talking about the Big 12. Matter of fact, go back and look up the podcast when I nominated the Big 12 for Jagoff of the Week for screwing the whole thing up, and the Big 12 won. Don't tweet me with that crap. Go to Bob Bowlesby with it. It's his fault. Blame him. But let's remember something. Ohio State lost at home to Virginia Tech in Week 2, and they lost by 2 touchdowns, mind you. That made it worse. You lost at home by 2 touchdowns, but they ran the table, smashed Wisconsin in the Big Ten championship game, 59-0, and got themselves in the college football playoff. So if Ohio State can do that, having lost to a team that they should not have lost to at home by 2 touchdowns, then Florida, reasonably thinking, can lose to LSU during the regular season, who were number 2 in the original college football playoff ranking, still win the SEC East, win the SEC championship game, and have a shot to get in. All of that in theory. Now that we've broken down the script, let's get into teams that we think have a legitimate shot of getting in. I'll break down teams who are going to need a little bit of help and teams who are on the fringe. Teams who have a legitimate shot. We'll sweep through these quickly because I doubt any of these are arguable. Clemson, they're the number 1 team in the rankings. They are undefeated. All they have to really do is win out, beat Florida State Saturday, which I think will strengthen their case, win the ACC championship game, just hold serve, and Clemson's in. Ohio State has a legit shot. They have to beat Michigan State. They have to not slip and fall against Michigan and win the Big Ten championship game, and Ohio State can stay in the top 4 and get in. Michigan State, pretty much the same thing. Beat Ohio State, knock them off their perch. Win out, win your conference championship, you're in. Baylor and TCU. Here's where it gets dicey. The winner of this game has to go undefeated. Has absolutely no choice. You cannot have it back to the scenario where both teams have 1 loss again and you have no conference championship game. You don't want that to happen twice. One of these two teams, the winner of this game, Baylor TCU, must go undefeated in order to get into the playoff. Remove all doubt. However, there's one problem with this theory. There is one team that these two teams both have to face before Baylor and TCU meet on November 27th. Both teams have to face Oklahoma State, who, by the way, is number 14. And they're also undefeated. So Oklahoma State comes into the discussion now. They may have the hardest path to do it. Of all the teams that have a legit shot, Oklahoma State might have the hardest path for 2 reasons. One, they have to get through TCU and Baylor to do it. And they have the second hardest remaining strength of schedule. Of all the teams, second hardest remaining strength of schedule. You know who has number 1 as the hardest remaining strength of schedule? LSU. And LSU's already in the top 4. But Oklahoma State, they've got the second hardest. They still have to face Oklahoma. Bedlam hasn't gone down yet. There's a lot left to be done here. But Oklahoma State, for the sake of argument, and until they lose a game, still has a legit shot. Now, we talked about LSU, we talked about Alabama, those are pretty much understood. We talked about Florida, that's pretty much understood. Let's get back to Notre Dame. I know, I understand. But hear me out. Notre Dame, they lost to Clemson, the number 1 team. Now, Notre Dame has the 47th toughest remaining strength of schedule. We're talking about teams they still have yet to face. So there's nothing really guaranteed here as far as Notre Dame. And let's look at Notre Dame's remaining schedule. Pitt, Wake Forest, Boston College, in Stanford. That's where this gets dicey, is because they have to face Stanford on the road in Palo Alto for their final game of the season. Which brings me to my next category of teams who need help. Let's go back down through the teams who have a legit shot. Clemson, Ohio State, Michigan State, Baylor, TCU, LSU, Alabama, Notre Dame, Oklahoma State, and Florida. Did you notice that I didn't mention Iowa? Here's why I didn't mention Iowa. Iowa falls into my category of teams who need help. Here's something I'm going to tell you that's going to blow your mind. I am not convinced that an Iowa team that goes undefeated and wins the Big Ten championship game, I'm not convinced that they would be on the committee's list. Why? Not because it's Iowa, not because they play in Cedar Rapids, not because they're a blue blood program, but because of Iowa's schedule. This is what makes it complicated for a team like Iowa. And it does not help the remaining schedule, Indiana, Minnesota, Purdue, and Nebraska. The only team I could give you a strong argument for is Minnesota, and Jerry Kill just retired. Which is actually something that goes far for TCU's schedule. And here's another reason why TCU. Of all the teams in the Big 12, I think TCU's got the best shot. They're the healthiest right now. I think they have the best quarterback of the three between them, Baylor, and Oklahoma State. And that's considering the fact that Seth Russell's now out for the season. But TCU also has the best non-conference schedule. They went to Minnesota and won a tough game against a really well-coached Minnesota team when they had Jerry Kill at the time. Granted, they have an interim coach. Nothing against interim coaches, but we know there's a drop-off there. But Iowa needs help. Iowa, in order to get in, has to be up against a one-loss SEC champion, which could be Alabama or Florida. They have to be up against a one-loss Big 12 champion, which could be Baylor, TCU, or Oklahoma State, assuming that only one of them has one loss before it's all said and done. We don't want to see that scenario twice. Or up against a one-loss Big 10 champion. One-loss Pac-12 champion. Which brings the next team on this list of teams who need help into the forefront. And that's Stanford. Stanford has the 17th hardest remaining strength of schedule. Now, Stanford and Utah both have one loss in the Pac-12. Stanford needs help. They can win out. They can still win the Pac-12 championship. They got to face Colorado, Oregon, Cal, who may have lost a little bit of luster after getting smashed by UCLA. And then they finish their schedule with Notre Dame at home. Now, here's where this gets important for Stanford. If Stanford wins out, beats Notre Dame at home, and then wins the Pac-12 championship game, Stanford has a very good case as a one-loss team to find themselves in it. But they might need some help. They're going to need some help from a one-loss SEC champion, i.e. a Florida or an Alabama. Maybe a one-loss Big Ten champion. Maybe a one-loss Big 12 champion. There's more than a couple teams in the picture amongst the conference champions of the Power Five with one loss, then Stanford has to work its way into the conversation. Now, Stanford lost to Northwestern, a team that's currently number 21 in the rankings, so based on the original rankings, that's actually a legit loss, but it may be still the worst of the remaining contenders, assuming Florida's in it or assuming Alabama's in it. Then again, is a loss to Northwestern worse than a loss to Ole Miss, considering that Ole Miss lost to Memphis? Do you really want to crawl down that wormhole? So that's what changes that. But there's still Utah, who has a 36th best remaining strength of schedule. Utah needs help. They need to win out. They need to win the Pac-12 championship game. If they beat a Stanford in the Pac-12 championship game, assuming that I'm looking at this correctly. I always assume I'm looking at everything correctly, even when I'm not. But I want to double check here. I don't want to take up too much time. But as far as Utah's concerned, yes. If Utah wins out, wins the Pac-12 South, goes to the Pac-12 championship game, beats Stanford, assuming Stanford beats Notre Dame, and then we get back to the scenario of a one-loss Big 12 champion, a one-loss Big 10 champion, a one-loss SEC champion, or some kind of mixture or combination of it, Utah technically still has a shot, but they need help. They need Stanford to beat Notre Dame. They probably need Oklahoma State to beat either Baylor or TCU. They need Baylor or TCU to beat each other, or one of those teams to win, one of those teams to win and lose. So that also reminds us of the fact that Baylor and TCU, one of them is going to cancel the other one out as far as losses. So they need that to happen. So that counts to their favor. But there's a lot of dominoes that need to fall for Utah to still have a shot. That's the same case for Stanford, but Stanford might be a little bit stronger if they beat Notre Dame. So let's recap. Teams who have a legit shot: Clemson, Ohio State, Michigan State, Baylor, TCU, LSU, Alabama, Notre Dame, Oklahoma State. Teams that have a legit shot, and Florida. Teams who need help: Iowa, Florida State, Stanford, Utah. There is another team I didn't mention. That team is Memphis. Memphis fans, I don't want you to take this as a disrespect or an insult or any kind of ill will harbored towards you. I don't know a nice way to say this, but you're screwed. Barring a cruise missile taking out the bunker where the College Football Playoff Committee actually holds their meetings and votes on the actual playoff rankings, unless that happens, or every team that I listed above Memphis, pretty much the other top 14 of the 15 teams, unless they all get the mumps, like the NHL epidemic that broke out last year, or assuming each of those teams' starting quarterbacks get hurt, that might help everybody but Ohio State. But you see where I'm going with this. It's going to take a pretty much ridiculous biblical disaster for Memphis to have a shot at this. And it's nothing against Memphis, trust me. Memphis' remaining schedule: Navy, at Houston, at Temple, SMU at home. The only game I'm worried about in that schedule is at Temple. Although at Houston won't be easy. Tom Herman, really good coach. But sorry, Memphis, for all intents and purposes, you're screwed. That is my first State of the College Football Playoff address. Basically, there's about 14 teams that have a shot out of the top 15. And Memphis is screwed. In the meantime, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk Steelers. We're going to talk film study. Le'Veon Bell's injury. We'll talk about all those things with Alex Kozora from Steelers Depot when we come back on the Josh Taylor Show. You are listening to Trib Live Radio.
Sip into the holiday spirit with Dunkin' Donuts holiday cookie-flavored coffees and espresso drinks. Tis the season to indulge in holiday favorites like peppermint mocha or sugar cookie. And now enjoy the delicious holiday taste of a new hot or iced snickerdoodle macchiato, handcrafted with layers of rich espresso, steamed milk, and foam. They're a delicious way to get in the spirit and are only available once a year. Enjoy Dunkin' Donuts' collection of holiday cookie-flavored coffees, lattes, and macchiatos today. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
The Ultimate Gentleman's Club, Blush, one of Pittsburgh's most exotic night spots. Blush is located on 9th Street downtown. It's exotic and erotic shows all week. The area's most beautiful dancers. Open 7 days a week. Check out our new sports bar located on the third floor. Enjoy drinks and dining while watching your favorite teams in HD. Live at Blush this week, Triple X star Abigail Mack. Don't miss Triple X star Abigail Mack all this week at Blush. It's time you made the switch to Blush, 9th Street downtown. Remember, everyone ends up at Blush. Coming up, Triple X star Alexis Monroe, November 17th through the 21st. For more info, visit our all-new website, blushexotic.com. That's blushexotic.com.
Let Dunkin' Donuts' new sweet black pepper bacon sandwich take your bacon sandwich to the next level with 4 slices of crispy peppered bacon, caramelized to perfection. It's the bacon experience you've been waiting for. So peppery, so crisp, and with a touch of sweetness. It's bacon deliciousness like you've never tasted before. Try Dunkin' Donuts' new sweet black pepper bacon sandwich today. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
Now back to the Josh Taylor Show on Trib Live Radio.
Welcome back to the show. If you missed the last segment, we did our first State of the College Football Playoff address. We did it. We addressed it. Kind of used past tense when using current tense. Never mind. Anyway, in about half hour or so, Pittsburgh Hockey Pregame Show live here on Trib Live Radio. Yours truly in studio. We're going to talk Penguins and Vancouver Canucks tonight. In Vancouver, Angie Carducci from InsideHockey.com. She's going to join us to talk about that. But in the meantime, joining me right now is a guest that we've had on the show quite a couple times here. There's a couple things I gotta use to bill my guest here, because he was the man that originally had in his mock draft, his first mock draft on this show, he had Bud Dupree going to the Steelers with the 22nd overall pick. And then recently, he has been credited as the man who broke the news of Le'Veon Bell's MCL injury. And he joins me right now, Trib Live Radio, Alex Kozora from Steelers Depot. Alex, good to have you on again, my man.
Good to be on, Josh. And I was listening to your last segment, and I just love the imagery of the college football playoffs being decided in a bunker. I think that's really appropriate for the state of the NCAA right now.
Seriously, is there any other way than like a Nord-type bunker with, like, you know, I always like the movies, like when they had like the wartime decisions with the president, and there's like the maps that are lit up on the green, like clear screen with like the big thing turning, like the big radar deal. Yeah, like, it has to be that.
They're
right?
All like they're all petting cats, like Dr. Evil or something like that. Like, that's the image I get.
It's either that or it's like an evil supercomputer, like on War Games. Shall we play a game? Like global thermonuclear war. That's the only thing I can really equate it to. So, mind's weird. So don't give me any credit. But in the meantime, let's talk some Steelers here, because there's a lot to get to. Of course, you reported it late Sunday night. Le'Veon Bell, MCL tear, out for the season. They put him on IR on Monday. But I want to ask you this question. What do you understand about the nature of Le'Veon Bell's MCL injury?
Well, like I reported, Josh, and I don't know much more than that. You know, some other reports have come out. David Todd said that he'd been told there was a PCL damage as well. But my understanding was that the ACL is clean. Mike Tomlin, of course, confirmed that today, so obviously take his word for it. But it was a torn MCL, enough to take him out for the year. It's not surprising that there is other damage, because, you know, just naturally, usually, a torn MCL isn't enough to keep you out for 8 whole weeks, but that seems to the nature. And regardless, he's on IR now, and the Steelers now have to figure out how to live life without Le'Veon Bell.
All right, and moving forward, of course, there's the obvious move going forward is D'Angelo Williams will become the number one running back on the depth chart. We saw it the first two games of the season, so that's no surprise. My question to you, and I've thrown this out there, I still think the Steelers' passing game can be. It could be good. It could be, you know, formidable. Still having Antonio Brown, still having Martavis Bryant, still having Heath Miller and Marcus Wheaton, who I feel has maybe been a little bit undervalued, maybe underused, and Ben Roethlisberger back in the lineup. But as far as game planning going forward without Le'Veon Bell and having D'Angelo Williams in there instead, how does it affect the game planning in your mind? And does it make it that significantly different as far as what the Steelers are trying to accomplish on offense?
Yeah, you know, Josh, it might sound like a cop-out, but I don't think there's a great game plan kind of change. I mean, you know, Williams has been an accomplished back. He did well the first 2 weeks, and the game plan in the first 2 weeks didn't look significantly different than it has, you know, with Ben Roethlisberger last week, for example. So I don't see it as any different. Of course, the production level is still going to drop. D'Angelo Williams has done a fantastic job this year. You know, he still looks like he has a step and a burst. I love what he's doing in pass protection. I think that there's almost no drop-off from Le'Veon Bell to D'Angelo Williams, which is high praise all around, because Bell's been so good in pass pro, and I thought Williams did a tremendous job of that the first 2 weeks, and, you know, basically in the second half of Sunday's game against Cincinnati. So I don't see a big game plan change in terms of what, you know, kind of concept you're going to run, if it's inside zone, if it's a power, if it's, you know, gap versus man scheme, whatever. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of change there. because, you know, D'Angelo Williams has proven himself to be a reliable bat.
Now, a couple of things I want to ask you about, and let's stick with the offense here, because I mentioned how we want to talk about film study, and this is something that you and I talked about that we're going to talk about throughout the season, and hopefully we get to do a lot of this, because one of the things I love to do is look at the film and try to understand how we get from what the play looks like to how we get to where it ends. And this is something that you like to break down a lot in detail, especially on SteelersDepot.com. And one thing that caught my eye, two things I want to talk about, one on the offense, and that's you wrote about Todd Haley's Hank concept. And this is something for I want to explain to everybody. It's a particular play that Todd Haley, you know, apparently has an affinity for. And it's, for lack of a better explanation, for those maybe who understand some of the basic concepts of football, it's kind of a twist on the curl flat concept. But I'll let you go a little bit more into detail in explaining your thoughts behind your thought process behind this post you wrote on Steelers Depot earlier today and explaining Todd Haley's Hank concept.
Yeah, it's not that difficult, and I think you said it well. Just basically think of curl flats mirrored to each side, and then the Hank part of the Hank concept is a five-yard, you know, hitch or curl route by the tight end. That's kind of considered the Hank, you know, part of the route. It's in a lot of teams' playbooks. It's exclusive of Todd Haley. I watch, you know, I scout the opposing team every week. You see in a lot of those playbooks as well. But what it does is just a nice, efficient play where you get that curl flat. So if the flat defender widens to take the flat route, it helps open up the curl. If he doesn't, you might have the flat available. You get that quick hitter to the tight end. So it gives you a lot of options. And the reason why I wanted to write that post, Josh, because I love what Haley did to work off of it. The one thing I think Todd Haley does really, really well, better than, you know, the majority of offensive coordinators, is using one play to set up another. So you start with that Hank concept. They ran it on the first drive near the red zone on first and 10. They run it later in the first half. Then they get into the third quarter. They're back first and 10, right outside of the red zone. You're going to get that Hank look again with that curl flat, it appears, but then the receivers that run the curl end up running a double move and you know, basically a little stop and go. And it fooled Adam Jones. He got burned on it. Now, Ben didn't find him. He ended up hitting Keith Miller for a four-yard gain. But I just love that kind of chess match that you get in football where you use one play a couple times based on down and distance and field position to set up another. So you go with the true Hank concept early in the game, it works, and you try to work off of that later in the game. I think it's one thing that Todd Haley does better than maybe any offensive coordinator in the game.
And kind of tying off of that, and for some people who are trying to understand the different names to different concepts, and when we say concept, we're talking about certain combinations of routes that have names to them. It's actually one of the features of the offense that Todd Haley likes to run, the Earhart Perkins offense. If you remember the name Earhart, Ron Earhart, Steelers offensive coordinator about 20 years ago when they went to Super Bowl 30, Ron Earhart ran that offense. Also coached the Giants offense when Bill Parcells was there. This is not a coincidence. You know who else runs a similar offense? The Patriots run a lot of Earhart Perkins too, and they use a lot of concepts that they tend to bunch together. So for people that are trying to understand where names like Hank and Flood and things like that come from, it's a combination of routes that they use together in order to help the defense maybe determine where the ball is going to go. Talking with Alex Kazora from SteelersDepot.com right now on the Josh Taylor Show on Trib Live Radio. Alex, another thing we want to talk about here in film study, this is something that you wrote, I believe, earlier. It was about the kick returning with Dre Archer. There's this narrative out there. There's this belief out there. And it is partially true. I'll admit this. But there's this belief that Dre Archer is not being effective as a kick returner. But the prevailing belief is that it's because of some maybe lack of Dre Archer or some maybe deficiency in skill on his part. But I read your film study post on Steelers Depot, and it kind of confirmed something that I had been thinking for a while, just watching players from the other team and other defenders go into my screen so quickly on kick returns. And also Mike Tomlin has mentioned in the past couple weeks in his press conferences about maybe some of it being the kick return team, those guys blocking in front of him as much as it is Dre Archer. But I want you to explain it from your film study post about what you're seeing in the Steelers kick return game.
Yeah, Josh, the one thing we love to do at Steelers Depot from our mom's basements is just try to dispel as many narratives as we can. And of course, you know, Archer has to be better. Everyone has to be better.
Right.
It's not absolving, you know, Archer entirely. But whatever, you know, you said it perfectly, Josh. It's the kick return team. There's 10 other guys that have to do their job to create a successful kick return. And in both of Archer's returns, he couldn't get to his own 15-yard line without resistance, without a defender, you know, right on him, unblocked. And anytime you have that, it's very difficult, I don't care who the kick returner is, to get positive plays. And the thing that that really just got me the most was the fact that there was an unblocked defender, but who it was. It was Cedric Pierman, the Bengals' top special teamer. You listen to Danny Smith. He was talking with Bob Labriola in the coordinator's corner that they do each week. And the first thing, whenever they were talking about, you know, the Bengals' punt team, one of the things Danny Smith said was about how good Cedric Pierman was. Everyone knows how good of a special teamer he is, and the fact that he was, you know, unblocked both times. Not that it wasn't that it was a blown assignment. It was people trying to get a hat on him. Vince Williams fell off once. Robert Golden fell off the other time. But just letting that guy come in twice should tell you, and you could see it even during the TV broadcast, when you see 30 running in free, there's a breakdown because if you need to get a hat on anybody, it's Cedric Pierman. So, you know, there's fault to go around for everybody, but I think it's very easy and very self-serving to be able to say, oh, it's Archer's fault for, you know, X, Y, and Z not getting the ball out. But there's so many other layers and components to go into it that it's tough to see on the TV broadcast because you don't get to see the front five try to block or the wedge do their job in some cases. Sometimes you only get to see Archer, so it's easy to put the blame on him. But if you go back and look, there's 10 other moving pieces that have to do their job, and they failed miserably Sunday.
A little bonus play. We'll slip in here since we got some extra time. Another thing I want to bring up in you where we're talking about film study. And, well, we talked offense. We talked special teams. Let's go defense here. You wrote a post. I believe this was – actually, it was earlier today. It was open bear cover one. This is one of the fronts we've seen from the Steelers. And we talked about we've talked a lot about it going into the season, the differences in the defense between Keith Butler's defense now when Dick LeBeau ran for so long in the past. You wrote something about open bear cover one. I want you to try to break this down. Now, for some people, that's probably aren't going to understand. It's a little bit of a different look from what we're used to seeing maybe from Dick LeBeau's defense. But if you can kind of just break down as easily as you can why this is such an interesting play and what makes this different from what we're used to seeing.
Definitely, Josh, and I think you definitely go check it out on Steelers Depot because it has all the pretty pictures and the GIFs and stuff like that, and it helps clear it up. Basically, and I use the term open bear cover one because, you know, we were able to find Dick LeBeau's 2002 Cincinnati Bengals playbook, and he takes some concepts from there and try to apply it to Keith Butler. So the terminology might change. There's always a couple new wrinkles, you know, anytime you're going from 2002 to 2015. But basically, think of it as a five-man pressure, kind of like a fire zone. But instead of zone coverage, it's man coverage. So you're going to get man free, where you're going to get a free safety playing the deep middle, the deep third, with man coverage everywhere else. And then you're going to have the safety to the open side of the field basically either take the back if he leaks out or if the back stays in, which happened on the play it broke down. You're basically going to become just a robber technique where you're reading the quarterback's eyes. You're looking to rob of any, you know, intermediate routes, digs, things like that. So that's kind of it's like a cover one robber kind of type with a five-man rush where you're trying to stress the open side of the formation. And then Butler added a little wrinkle to it. He had a stunt up front. He stunted Cam Thomas and Cam Hayward. They exchanged gaps, just trying to create a little bit of confusion, some chaos up front, and try to get, you know, Lawrence Timmons, who was blitzing the B-gap, free. So it's all these little wrinkles that come in. I think Keith Butler's done a fantastic job of a lot of core LeBeau principles, a ton of fire zones. Butler's blitzing more than LeBeau did last year. If you put the percentage on it, it's about, I think last time I checked, about 10% more. I'm going to probably recheck the numbers today, actually. But, it, you know, you're able to see a lot of core LeBeau things, but with Butler's kind of spin on them. And the thing I like the most, Josh, is just each week you see a little new wrinkle with Keith Butler's defense. There's always just something tiny, something small, and there's probably more than I'm probably missing some of it, but from what I'm able to see, you're seeing a couple new things. The last couple weeks, and they did it three times Sunday, they'll put an outside linebacker's hand on the ground, move him inside. So they had Arthur Motes with his hand down twice, and they had Jarvis Jones with his hand down once. You know, there's just all these little wrinkles that kind of come in. He does a nice job of mixing those fire zones with playing some man coverage. You're still getting some cover two on third and long. You know, all kind of wrapped in that still base cover three defense that Vic LeBeau had always run. So you've seen kind of a combination of everything. You've seen some, you know, spot dropping. You've seen some man coverage. You've seen some pattern reading. Remember back to the Ross Cockrell interception against the Baltimore Ravens several weeks ago. That's two trap where the quarterback's reading the routes of the receiver and is jumping on any out route. So I just love all the combinations that Keith Butler has done. He gets a lot of credit for taking this defense that myself, and I'm sure the majority of us, figured was going to be the weak link of this team and turned it into a real strength.
Alex, before we let you go, what surprised you more about this defense? The fact that they've done it with a new coordinator, with Keith Butler, and with the loss of Ike Taylor, with the loss of Troy Polamalu, with no Brett Kiesel and some new faces in his starters, or that they've done it limiting points so quickly?
I mean, obviously Butler was new, but he wasn't new in the sense he's been around for so long. You know, everyone was familiar with him. I think people kind of get on the secondary, but I think you have to give, you know, Carno Lake credit, give Keith Butler credit. That secondary is probably playing better than people think. You know, whenever you come into the year, you thought it was going to be Shamarco Thomas at strong safety. It doesn't work out, so you put in Will Allen, you lose him, then you go to Robert Golden, who's, you know, quietly playing some really good football. Mike Mitchell's taken a nice step here in year two in Pittsburgh. And they've just done a nice job of eliminating big splash plays. And I think that was Achilles' heel for this defense last year, all these big explosive 20-plus yard plays. I think Dave Bryan had done a post on that the other day, kind of looking at that and putting a number on it. So I think that's been impressive. And just bottom line, it's going to sound really, really simple. I know, you know, you and I both love our X's and O's, but sometimes it can be more simple than that. If they tackle well, they're not going to give up a lot of points. Their two best tackling performances this year was against Arizona and against Cincinnati, and they hold those teams to what, you know, 13 and 16 points. So it's no coincidence that you're able to hold high-powered offenses to their worst offensive performances when you just tackle well.
Alex, you feed my football nerd urge, and I love you for it. Every time we get a chance to break down some film and talk X's and O's, and it's hard to be able to do that in radio, to be able to make it as descriptive as possible. So I encourage everybody, go to SteelersDepot.com, check out some of the posts that Alex is writing out there about the Steelers film study and different things that they're doing and trying to understand how they're doing what they do. And we always appreciate it, man. Got to have you on sometime again soon, and always fun.
For sure, Josh. Take care, man.
All right, that's Alex Cazorra, SteelersDepot.com. Follow him on Twitter, Alex_Cazorra, K-O-Z-O-R-A. Like I said, every time I talk to Alex, I get some good nuggets of information. And if you're an X's and O's person like me, I like to look at it from a lot of different angles. It's easy to look at just what you see on your television screen, but I'd like to go back a couple days later. I'd like to look at the All 22 film where you can see the entire field and all the players moving, whether it's from the goal line cam or from the end zone cam where you see the entire width of the field, or if you're looking from the press box when you can see, I totally got that wrong, from the end zone where you can see the entire length of the field, or from above the press box where you can see the entire width of the field. I think you understand more about what's going on when you get to see the entire field, because there really is some choreography to it. And if you don't pay attention to everything around the play, sometimes you may not always understand what's going on where the ball is. And I think that's something that we try to bring more to the forefront, especially Alex and myself. So we appreciate him joining us as always. It's always great stuff. Got about 10 minutes left in the show. Before we go, I want to talk about this week's That's What's Up. And I wanted to talk about it last week, but so many things have been changing at the time. And Jerry Kill had made his sudden announcement to retire last week from the University of Minnesota after having his battle with epilepsy as Minnesota's head coach of the Gophers. So we had to push this one back. I think it was better timed this way, because had I talked about it last week, it would have been before the event actually happened. But doing it this week makes it better, because it's already taken place and we can get a better understanding of it. Go on TripLive.com in the sports page. Check out Kevin Gorman's column. It's dated from last Saturday morning. It's called, I believe it's called Bigger Than Football. Actually, excuse me, it's called Way More Important Than Football. Rivalries are something that are part of every sport. There's a natural, you want to call it animosity, maybe that's what it is on the surface. And sometimes if the rivalry is good enough, if the rivalry is old enough, it becomes deep-seated anger. And then there are some that you look at as just pure old-fashioned hate. Beaver Falls and Aliquippa is probably one of the first rivalries. If you're going to list rivalries in Western Pennsylvania football, Aliquippa Beaver Falls is probably one of the ones you're going to talk about as one of the best rivalries. And that's not just in football, it's in basketball too. You're talking about pretty much two of the premier and two of the oldest and most memorable, most reputable schools in Beaver County when you're talking Beaver Falls and Aliquippa. And there's just the proximities there. Every element for a rivalry is there between these two communities in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. But on last Friday night, in this particular instance, the rivalry took a backseat because something happened Friday night that was bigger than football. Now, Aliquippa has a senior tailback, and Damonte Bronaugh, who has been diagnosed with leukemia. I think it happened during the summer in August. And since he has been diagnosed with leukemia, there's been such an outpouring of support from his community, from other teams, from players. I believe Mike Tomlin even took time out to go visit Adrian Bronaugh in the hospital. And there's been so much, you don't want to say attention, but there has been so much support given to both him and the Aliquippa football team, and obviously Adrian's family. And you look at this, and Damonte's family. I'm looking at the wrong name here. Sorry. You look at Damonte Bruno's family, and when you look at all of it, and you see situations like Friday night, where Aliquippa facing Beaver Falls, rivalry week in the WPIL. I mean, it's billed as rivalry week. It's the last regular season game. This is where a lot of that old-fashioned hatred shows up. But in this case, Beaver Falls, instead of bringing that old-fashioned hatred to the field, they brought support for Damonte Bruno last Friday, which I thought was very, very just astounding. And I see the coaches and the players and the community in Beaver Falls. I see those as people who get it, because sometimes it's not just about dominance. It's not just about establishing supremacy. It's not just about imposing your will. Sometimes it is about the people involved. And the fact that they showed Damonte Bruno that much support and that much care, because sometimes it is about people. The one thing you will gain from participating in sports is that sports is about people. At the end of the day, it's about people. It's about the people you compete with. It's about the people you compete against. It's about the people you play for. Or if you're a coach, it's about the kids that you coach. But it's about the relationships that you make and the memories that you have. And this is one of those memories that I think Damonte Bruno's family will never forget. To see Beaver Falls, their team, come from the other side of the field and bring an autographed banner and a donation of funds that students and faculty collected in support of a player from their rival team. This is one of those times where life is bigger than the game. Beaver Falls, Aliquippa, I salute you. I salute you for being able to come together as two communities that otherwise have a lot of history of animosity and a lot of history of rivalry between each other, but you're able to put yourselves aside and put your focus on someone else and make it bigger than the game. That's one of those times when life should be bigger than the game, and I salute Beaver Falls and Aliquippa for being able to do that, because it is so easy to lose sight of what is really the most important in life. I think some of us take this way too seriously. And this is coming from a guy who talks about it for a living on two different media. And there are people out there that still take it too seriously. At least I understand at the end of the game, yes, this is something that, of course, has so much tied into it as far as money and endorsements and contracts and things of that nature and television coverage and new media. That's all true. But at the end of the day, it's still about people. And yes, it's something that I love and something that I enjoy. But one of the reasons why I enjoy it is about the stories that involve people and the people that make up the things that we enjoy. And this is one of those things. So Beaver Falls, Aliquippa, you are my That's What's Up of the week for your support of Damonte Bruno and his family and with his diagnosis of leukemia. I love this young man's spirit. He just has a definite belief that he's going to beat it. He's going to beat it. He's going to be back on the football field. And I'm rooting for that of all people. If no one else is, I'm sure there are plenty that are rooting for it. But if that were ever to change, I would never stop rooting for that. This young man is a fantastic story, and I'm wishing him all the best and wishing Aliquippa and that community and his family all the best in their support of him as he continues to try to fight against leukemia, because there are so many things that can lessen the quality of life. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy the quality of life. That does not mean that you shouldn't try to aspire. That just means you shouldn't dream of a better time. You should not dream. That doesn't mean you shouldn't dream of better days, because you should. And there's always reason to fight. As long as there's life, there's hope. And I'm glad that this young man and his family and his community and his rival community all understand that. That's my That's What's Up of the week. Want to thank everybody for listening to the show. If you missed it live, check out the podcast, sportstalk.triplelive.com. Also, you can download it on iTunes. If you have a Droid, or if you have, I guess you can call it anything that runs off of, what's the word I'm looking for here? Anything that runs off Android software, Find it on Podcast Addict. Google Play, Podcast Addict. Look up Tribe Live Radio. You'll find it there also. You can also get it off the website. However you get it, just make sure that you get it. And, of course, link will be coming out on Twitter, so check out on Twitter too. Also, want to give a couple quick shout-outs. Give a shout-out to the guys at RumBunner.com. Was able to be a part of their Hot Stove podcast earlier this week. Check that out on RumBunner.com. They also have a subscription on iTunes, so check out the RumBunner Hot Stove podcast. Yours truly was a participator. Really enjoyed talking to Tyler and Jason about some Steelers, some Pirates offseason moves and what they should and should not do and some things to lend some perspective on maybe the Pirates' upcoming offseason. Also want to make an announcement. Friday night, Tilted Kilt here on the North Shore, the Ike Taylor Show. Yours truly will be hosting with Ike Taylor, of course, former Steeler Super Bowl champion, two-time Super Bowl champion, analyst for NFL Network. Ike Taylor will be in town with me at the Tilted Kilt Friday night for the Ike Taylor Show. John Harris will be on assignment covering Pitt basketball. So yours truly flying solo, hosting the Ike Taylor Show with Ike Taylor. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it'll be a great time over at the Tilted Kilt on the North Shore, not too far from Heinz Field. So if you can, come out, see the show there. If not, listen to the show. Always great insight from Ike Taylor about not only Steelers football, but the NFL. Also, he'll give you some great college football, too. Ike's a student of the game, loves to scout players, loves to get a read on different players and the things that they do well. I really do think he has a bright future as an analyst because I do think he understands the game and he just sees it from a perspective that a lot of people just don't understand. And I think that really lends a lot to the show. So I'm really excited for that too. Be sure to check that out. That's Friday night, 8 o'clock, right here on Tribe Live Radio, live from the Tilted Kilt, the Ike Taylor Show. Also, come on out if you want to. Come out, hang out in person. Ike will be there signing autographs, taking pictures. He loves to engage with people. So I encourage you to please come out and hang out with us. In the meantime, that's our time. To quote the great Jay-Z, you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here with me, and I appreciate that. We'll try to be better next week. Of course, hope you enjoyed the first state of the college football playoff address. More of that to come as the season comes along. By the way, more to come at the top of the hour. Penguins Talk, Pittsburgh Hockey Pregame. Angie Carducci from Inside Hockey joining us halfway through the hour, coming up in about 30 minutes or so on Tribe Live Radio. I'm Josh Taylor. See you next week.